from KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The fast food industry is often called out for its harmful impact on low-income communities and communities of color, from perpetuating food deserts to contributing to increased rates of obesity to paying low wages to workers. But there is a surprising history in how capitalism worked with black entrepreneurs, civil rights leaders, and the federal government in the post-civil rights era to ensure fast food was here to stay. Our guest is historian Marcia Chatelain, who traces in her book the story about, well, McDonald's and other franchises. And the book, in fact, is called Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. She's Provost Distinguished Associate Professor of History and African-American Studies at Georgetown University, also the author of Southside Girls Growing Up in the Great Migration. And welcome, Mark. Good to have you aboard with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Professor Chatelain, let's begin by just giving listeners a figure here that comes from your book. By the year 2000, black franchises, well, McDonald's specifically, had total sales of over $2 billion. I mean, that's a staggering figure, and it's something really to wrestle with. But let's go back to when all this began. I mean, a lot of people remember Nixon and black capitalism and all of that, but we're talking about really something almost right after the assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968.
Absolutely. So the central drama of franchise begins with King's assassination in 68, when white franchise owners who were doing business in predominantly black neighborhoods were uncomfortable about remaining in these communities lest they become targets next time an uprising comes. And so with McDonald's support and endorsement, they were able to leave their franchise locations, and in their place came African-American business people who were excited about the opportunity to create a black-owned business in black communities. And that was the first start of the aggressive minority franchise recruitment strategies of McDonald's and other fast food restaurants.
Actually, McDonald's, the first McDonald's drive-in, I think, goes back to the 1940s in San Bernardino here in the state of California. But the first black-owned franchise was in your hometown of Chicago.
Absolutely. Herman Petty reopened a McDonald's that had been abandoned by a white franchise owner in December of 1968. And it is no coincidence that 8.5 months after King's assassination, this McDonald's appears, because there was a clear understanding that doing business in black communities came with a series of responsibilities and a level of accountability in the community. And McDonald's was able to leverage that concern about buying black into bringing black franchise owners into communities.
There was a real proliferation of these franchises. I mean, and in many ways, they were doing some good. They were offering scholarships initially. They were trying to say, you know, we're all in favor of, particularly in the wake of the grieving and the pain that was caused by King's assassination. But it was kind of a symbiotic relationship between the black communities and the fast food industry.
Absolutely. If you keep in mind that after the uprisings of the 1960s, we didn't just have residential white flight, which we often think about in the period. We also had economic white flight, in which white-owned businesses left communities en masse to either reopen in the suburbs or simply abandon businesses altogether. So in that vacuum was an opportunity for African-American business people to establish businesses. But the reality is that without the capital and the influence of the franchise industry, many people were not able to have large-scale sustainable businesses that could employ a lot of people in the community. And that's why we see fast food franchising becomes incredibly important in the late 60s and 1970s in generating a lot of black wealth, but also having to contend with a lot of the consequences of the industry.
I was also thinking, speaking of consequences, of, Watts and many other places went up in flames. There were riots. I was actually in one. I wasn't a participant, but I happened to be driving in your town of Chicago in 68 after the King assassination. And there was a sense that, well, maybe things could be staved off or they could be controlled because there was political uprising. It was fearful.
Absolutely. And one of the things I point to in the book is the fact that after these uprisings, commissions and mayors and different bureaucrats try to figure out why are people so upset. And people are very clear why they're upset. They're upset about police brutality. They're upset about the lack of fair housing. They're upset about the quality of schools. But business tends to get a lot of attention because it's the one proposition that doesn't challenge any of the mandates for desegregation. And it was able to unite people on the left and the right on the idea that black business development could actually be a response to the claims that people were making against the state because of racism and inequality.
Our guest, if you've just joined us, is Professor Marcia Chatelain, and she's the author of Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. She's also Provost Distinguished Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown, and she'll be at the Jewish Community Center this evening in San Francisco at 7 p.m. Can I ask you about Cleveland? Because that's my hometown.
Absolutely.
Right after Chicago, we had Cleveland and Carl Stokes, and that's quite a story. It remains in my memory very clear because the mayor was really quite concerned about, the burger battle, as it was called.
Absolutely. So when Carl Stokes was seeking reelection as mayor of Cleveland,
the first African-American mayor of any big city.
Of a major city. Yeah. He had to contend with a major boycott of McDonald's on the east side of Cleveland. And unlike boycotts in previous eras that were about accessing an accommodation, this boycott was about who had the right to franchise a McDonald's and profit from black communities. And so there was a group called Operation Black Unity that really challenged the presence of white franchise owners. McDonald's corporate was very concerned about bending to the urges of these protest groups. And in the middle is this black mayor who has to be responsive to the black electoral base who got him into the mayor's office, as well as white Clevelanders who had wondered if a black mayor could really serve the interests of all people in the city. And so the chapter really looks at the complexity of whether communities would have the power to determine if McDonald's was going to be a good citizen or simply a profiteer in their community.
There really was a belief, though, I think almost kind of held sacred in a strange way. I'm hesitant a bit to use that word, but in the 60s and 70s, that black capitalism to fight racism and to fight really the inequalities was a real viable method to you had people, you had leaders like think about Floyd McKissick, as you point out in your book, James Brown, the cultural icon, Jim Brown, back to Cleveland, you know, the great Cleveland football player. And a lot of people had a stake in this, and a lot of people, you know, were able to make money, real money.
Absolutely. And I try to be sympathetic to why people believe that opening a business in 1970 would create a pathway to some opportunities. What they couldn't anticipate were the ways that wages were kept low and the cost of living kept on rising. They couldn't imagine us having a major health crisis in which people were unable to access the care they needed. And I also think that considering the ways that African Americans had been barred from the experience of going to restaurants and enjoying public accommodations, opening a new McDonald's was very hopeful for many people.
But African Americans presently have more likelihood of eating fast food than any other single group because of all of these franchises. And the truth of the matter is that it's very difficult in many particularly poor African American communities to find grocery stores where you can get good, healthy food. So on the one hand, creating capital was also creating, as you suggested, an obesity problem, a serious and more grave problem with diabetes too, and a health problem, a nutrition problem.
Absolutely. And one of the things I try to point out in Franchise is that people making choices about fast food, it isn't just about the food. It's about the affective bonds of community. It's the fact that in many places, you know the black franchise owner very well. You know that this is a person who has created a lot of first job opportunities. This is a person who has provided scholarships for people to go to historically black colleges. And if we are really serious about combating nutrition problems and really increasing the quality of black health, then we have to understand the history of how these fast food restaurants have ingratiated themselves to communities and really have a critique of capitalism, not just people's food choices.
Well, McDonald's went from kind of a white suburban phenomenon early on to becoming increasingly a black urban phenomenon. And you may want to weigh in here or certainly bring up some concerns that you have about this or the surprising history of fast food's rise in black America. If you have some thoughts, we'd like to hear from you. And if you have some questions, we'd like to hear from you. And you can join us now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. You can join us with Professor Marcia Chatelain. And again, the book is called Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. Give us a call, 866-733-6786, or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. Can you talk about the Calvin ads?
Absolutely. As a child of the 1980s, I watched a lot of television and I watched a lot of commercials for McDonald's. So the Calvin ads appear in the early 90s. And I talked to someone who helped create the ads. And he said the reason why they made Calvin a character for McDonald's was because The idea of working at McDonald's was not cool among teenagers. The term McJobs had been recently coined, and there was a sense that there was a lot of scrutiny on the potential of a fast food job. So the Calvin ads were supposed to represent a young African-American male who initially, when we meet him in the commercial, we're not sure if he's up to no good. He's seen in this urban environment as a potential threat. And at the very end, he turns over his baseball cap, and it is revealed that he indeed works at McDonald's, and he's a good kid. And those ads were really about two things that McDonald's did very well throughout that period. They emphasized the fact that McDonald's just didn't deliver fast food at a cheap price. They provided jobs for African-American youth, which was a critical problem in the past and today. And they also signaled that they understood that there was an urban and inner city market that used their products. And they were creating commercials that were brushing up against the Cosby Show aesthetic of black marketing.
I'd like to not only invite listeners to join us with any questions or comments, but a specific question for you listeners. What role has fast food played in your community? Be indeed interested to hear and curious to hear what your thoughts are on that score. And again, our toll-free line is 866-733-6786. And you can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your thoughts, your questions, your comments, and, well, what role fast food may or may not have played or continues to play in your community, to forum at kqed.org. Also interested in finding out a little bit about what you go into in the way of franchise history. There is not only an analogy here, but it goes all the way back to the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, a surprising fact that people may not be aware of or may not even be in the slightest way cognizant of. Talk about that.
Well, many historians trace the history of franchising to the practice of people being sent out to collect taxes on behalf of the Catholic Church and being able to keep some of the monies collected. And it's this idea that there is a third party or an intermediary between the people in which who provide the money and the people who capitalize on it. And franchising is this incredible relationship that I think is so distinctly American. It's the promise that you can be a millionaire someday if you are obedient and you follow the rules. But the big dilemma of franchising is the fact that someone else has to carry the liability of a major corporation.
And a lot of the money was extracted by white people, too, from these communities where the franchises were set up, these black communities. Yeah.
Absolutely. Throughout the book, you have communities that are really desirous of buying black and buying authentically black. But the reality of business and the reality of capital in America is that it's almost impossible to do that. And so even when they're black franchise owners who are in the stores, who are connected to the community, a lot of the revenue is going to white professionals, to white-owned banks, white attorneys and white accountants, as well as McDonald's corporate.
Coca-Cola, first franchisor? In terms of what we're talking about?
Within the history, Coca-Cola and Singer sewing machines are often considered the two major American franchises. There's an excellent book called Coca-Cola Capitalism by Bartow Elmore, where he talks about how Coca-Cola builds an entire business model on selling a recipe, but then the franchisee, as well as the larger society, has to determine how does Coca-Cola get enough water to create Coca-Cola? How do we cultivate enough sugar? A lot of the story of fast food and of franchising in America is also a story about supply chain. We have to have a lot of potatoes in order to create enough french fries. The number of chickens that have to be raised and farmed for the kernel and for the rotisserie chickens that we enjoy in supermarkets creates a lot of environmental and labor issues that I think we are all engaged in.
There's also an old, maybe apocryphal story that Coca-Cola had cocaine in it early on.
Well, that helped too, is for its popularity.
Yeah. And the whole franchise story gets fascinating for those who are nostalgic, who remember, for example, White Castle or Royal Castle. There's a lot in Professor Chatelain's book about just the whole world of franchising. But let's bring a caller on, and that's you, Elaine. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. So I was a student putting myself through San Francisco State in the 70s. I was on such a limited budget. I often either had money for food or money for bus fare. So I would barely make it by getting, you know, like a 50-cent burger at McDonald's, which was present in the urban environment. But the more important point I wanted to make today was in the 70s, one of the only commercials I ever saw on television portraying an African-American family was a commercial with a father taking his little kids for Sunday morning breakfast at McDonald's. Nobody was doing that. It was probably 77 or 78, and I've never forgotten that.
Now, Marcia Chatelain is nodding her head in recognition here.
Absolutely. So two things that you point out that I think are so important. One is that fast food is a practical choice for many people. And as much as we live in a culture that desires to be punitive and to ridicule people for consuming foods that they're supposed to know better, fast food is a very practical choice for people for many reasons, and I really think that we have to acknowledge that. The second is the advertising that McDonald's commissioned from Tom Burrell of Burrell Communications was groundbreaking in creating an image of African-American families, African-American culture, and African-American social mobility that was really revolutionary for the 1970s. And so I spent a lot of time watching old McDonald's commercials and looking at old advertisements. It's so deeply poignant. You can't walk away without a few tears because it really does map on to some of your most vivid memories of the past. And that's why advertising is so successful, because it understands what people want to see the most.
The Wizards of Madison Avenue and what they provide. And there's a picture, you mentioned the Cosby family before, there's a picture of McDonald's that kind of coalesces with the idea of the black family in a lot of that advertising. And what it's really saying is, here's an American institution and you are welcome. McDonald's welcomes you.
Absolutely. If you consider the fact that it wasn't until 1964 where African Americans are federally protected to be in public spaces, even though they're not always welcomed, the fact that McDonald's is portraying African Americans having a light moment at McDonald's, it's a very big deal. And I really wanted this book to honor and respect the fact that the reason why fast food is so complicated in black communities is because we live in a society that has been so deeply exclusionary and so deeply violent against African Americans that even a respite at McDonald's can provide people with a lot of joy.
Well, you make us aware of the politics and the whole trajectory of politics. In fact, you take us up to 2014 in Ferguson, Missouri, and the killing of Michael Brown by a police officer there, Darren Wilson. McDonald's is central.
If you remember the coverage of Ferguson in 2014, a lot of the action pivoted around the parking lot of a McDonald's on Florescent Avenue, which is actually franchised by an African-American named Jimmy Williams. And that McDonald's was the center for a lot of people because it was one of the few businesses that remained open. It was where journalists filed stories. Some journalists were actually arrested at that McDonald's. It's where police would change shifts. It's where people would watch the news. And I think that for me, I always associate McDonald's with a level of chaos. That chaos is what brought McDonald's into black communities in 68. And unfortunately, I think due to the crumbling of a public sphere in many communities of color, McDonald's sustains the community in times of crisis now. And that is a fact that I hope this book helps people to consider so that we can challenge it.
Here's Janice, who writes, sometimes the perceived culture of different franchises plays out in black neighborhoods. A Trader Joe's tried to come into a mostly mixed-race neighborhood in Portland, Oregon a few years ago, but the plan was shot down by a largely black community nearby. I felt it was a shame, as the area had no grocery stores at all at the time. Just to clarify, the Portland African American Leadership Forum protested because they saw it as further profiting off black displacement in the area.
Well, I understand why people are vigilant against grocery stores, even when they need them, because grocery stores are often the harbinger of gentrification. And so the question is, how do communities ensure that they can have their needs met and be able to remain there in order to enjoy these new amenities?
And we'll bring another caller on. Mike, that's you. Mike, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me on. Thanks for writing the book. And my question was, has McDonald's or other franchises taken the same approach towards reaching out to other ethnicities?
Absolutely. After the success of African-American franchise owners in the late 60s and early 1970s. There was then a pivot to create more franchise participation among Latino business people. And there was a partnership between National Council of La Raza and McDonald's to try to recruit franchise owners. And then there is also a network of Asian American and Pacific Islanders to bring into franchising as well. Part of the reason why the franchise industry has cultivated these ties is because they want people to also tap into small business administration programs for minority-owned businesses in order to expand.
Here's Kristen, who writes, I grew up in a working-class suburb of Cleveland. We share that, Kristen. My parents still live there. In the 80s and 90s, there were fast food joints everywhere, but as the community has become predominantly African-American and the working-class whites have left, I see former fast food places replaced by check-cashing places or left vacant altogether. The one fast food place that not only remains but has been modernized and updated is McDonald's on Mayfield Road, which is where I lived, actually, at one time.
So that's interesting. I was in Cleveland on this book tour a few weeks ago. And so what she is probably observing are a number of things. One, franchises that were probably franchised by whites who no longer wanted to do business as the community changed racially. And so, again, that economic white flight happens. And the second thing is you start to see the consequences of fast food concentration and the lack of banks. So many people of color are unbanked, and that's where the check cashing industry is able to really profit.
Here's Andrew. Andrew, you're on the air with us. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Two comments. The first is that your comment about the franchising of tax collection goes even farther back to the Roman era, around, you know, AD 200 or BC 200, 100, where the Romans made an industry of franchising tax collection among their conquered peoples so that they could, you know, share the wealth but also get most of the money. But my other comment is that the really precursor of franchising, which did a lot of help for minority communities, was Sears and Roebuck, because they did something else, standardization of commercial access. Prior to the Sears catalog, African Americans were at the mercy of local retailers. And that meant facing discrimination, not being able to buy when they wanted to or even at all, or else being limited to hours or facing exorbitant pricing in favor of white customers. But Sears, all an African-American family had to do was get a catalog, put in order it, buy anything from a dishwasher or, well, even a house, but certainly goods and services. Well, mostly goods.
Yeah, it's an interesting element you're bringing into this, Andrew, and I appreciate that. Professor Chatelain, you want to comment?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of creating marketplace alternatives to visiting stores is something that African Americans often strategized about because they didn't want to be degraded in the retail experience. And so whether it's the creation of the Green Book in order to inform other African Americans where they could safely rest on a road trip or where they could enjoy a meal without fear of violence or any type of degradation, you start to see when you look at this history of the various ways that people are still trying to engage with the marketplace that is particularly hostile to them.
What did you think of that film, The Green Book? There's a lot of controversy. A lot of people didn't like it, especially in the black community.
Because it wasn't about The Green Book. There's great documentaries about The Green Book. There's a new book called Driving While Black. You should look at that instead.
Okay. And Suzanne is joining us next. Suzanne, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment on the person that called in and said Trader Joe's in a black community that kind of rallied against that. And Trader Joe's is fine, but it's not for a black working community that has to get their own. They need a grocery store where you can buy your own bulk for however many you need at the time. You make your own price versus prepackaged small amounts that Trader Joe's have. They have a lot of the pre-wash, the fancy-pantsy, easy-peasy, but that is not something that can sustain black families that have various incomes going from very low to whatever. So no. I understand that.
Point well taken, Suzanne and Professor Chandler.
Yeah, and I think that's a really excellent point, because when people suggest that all a neighborhood needs is a grocery store, they forget that grocery stores are not all created equal. Their price points are not always commensurate with the community. But also the reason why we have these food deserts today is because for the purposes of the Small Business Administration, especially in the late 60s and 1970s, grocery stores were not considered small businesses. And so there weren't incentives to build, and there wasn't the kind of energy that the fast food industry had behind supermarkets. So you start to see the fundamental reasons why supermarkets just aren't there. And I think the types of products that are provided, as well as the quality of the jobs within those supermarkets, are important factors for communities to consider.
You know, there's a kind of a kidding about Whole Foods. Some call it Whole Paycheck. It's difficult for operations like that. They find it challenging and in many ways adverse to go into poorer communities.
Absolutely. And Whole Foods has experimented with a number of different types of presence. And I think with the Amazon purchase, you start to see a little bit of the lowering of prices. But I think that what people need to fundamentally understand about healthy eating, and this is something that I hope Franchise touches upon, is that we can have as many grocery stores as, you know, humanly possible in every neighborhood. But if people can't pay their electric bills and refrigerate their foods, and if they can't afford their gas bills after a cold winter and cook their food, then we really are failing people if we say that this is food justice.
A couple of quick questions. A listener writes, are there any regulations or government policies that prevent fast food companies from targeting minority or low-income communities?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. And another question from a tweet. Listener says, considering many McDonald's operate in what are otherwise food deserts, is there a movement to get McDonald's to sell a more balanced diet than burgers and fries?
After the release of the film Supersize Me, McDonald's pivoted towards taking out the supersize element, adding more salads, putting the carrot sticks and the apples and the Happy Meals. It kind of doesn't matter, because most people who are heavy users of fast food don't go to fast food to buy a salad.
Marcia Chatelain, pleased to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And congratulations on your book. You can actually meet the author. She'll be at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco tonight at 7 p.m. The book, again, is called Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. And Marcia Chatelain is Provost Distinguished Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown University. Thank you for being a part of this morning's forum program. You can always let us know what you think you like on forum or don't like by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. We'll be with you if all goes according to plan on tomorrow. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.